Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japanese. I'm your host Akiko Katayama, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but it's what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is David Kinch, who is the chef owner of Maressa in Los Gatos, California. David won the James Beard Awards Best Chef Pacific in 2010, and the Maressa has 3 Michelin stars and has been named one of the world's 50 best restaurants by Restaurant Magazine. And you can find a lot of Japanese influence on David's menu. So today we'll talk about his passion for Japanese cuisine, his experience working at a restaurant in Japan, how he expresses seasonally like kaiseki cuisine on his plates, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Heritage Network is a non-profit organization, and we need your support. So please go to our website, heritageradionetwork.org, and then become a member. Thank you. And hello, David. Welcome to Japanese. Well,
thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay. So first of all, for listeners who have not been to Maressa, can you tell us what kind of restaurant Maressa is?
Maressa is in Los Gatos, California, which is in the foothills of the Santa Cruz Mountains. It's about 1 hour south of San Francisco, close to San Jose, close to the Pacific Ocean. It's kind of in the heart of Silicon Valley.
Right.
Bedroom, which is kind of a strong customer base for us, the local customer base. Up above us are beautiful mountains that go down to the sea. They're covered with small family-owned wineries. It's one of the oldest wine-growing regions in California, so it's great to be a part of that and be surrounded by that. The restaurant is, I think, a real product of not only who we are, but where we are. We work with local products. We try to create something that is symbolic of where we're at, this special corner that we feel profoundly blessed to be near with. And we try to do a food that food and cuisine that is reflective of who we are.
Mm. Okay. And you opened it 2002.
July of 2002.
Correct. Right. So 14 years.
Yeah. 15 years is our anniversary next year.
Oh, wow.
That's a big year for us.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, and so how did you get into cooking?
I was growing up in New Orleans, and I started working in restaurants, after school jobs, flexible hours, that sort of thing. And New Orleans is a great place to fall in love with food and restaurant culture. I don't think I'd be a cook if I hadn't spent time living in New Orleans.
Yeah.
So I'm very grateful for that. I started originally in the dining room. I ended up being enamored with the art of cooking and wanting to learn to cook. I switched over to the kitchen and went to culinary school, moved back to New Orleans for a bit, came to New York, spent some time in Europe, and I've been in California since 1989.
Mm, right. And so before you opened the Maressa in 2002, you worked at many great restaurants around the world, including New York, San Francisco, France, Germany, Spain, and Japan. And I'd like to ask you about the experience in Japan. But first, I heard you worked at the Quilted Chef in New York, which is now closed, but which earned the New York Times 4-star rating. And I heard that the chef owner, Barry Wine's menu was influenced by Japanese cuisine. Mm-hmm. So could you tell us about your experience at the Quilted Giraffe?
Sure. I mean, the Quilted Giraffe was a big influence on me, not only the culture in the kitchen, but the food they were doing at that time. Back then in the 1980s, fine dining was in New York was dominated by a lot of French restaurants. It was, it was exclusively a French restaurant town on the high end, and the Quilted Giraffe was an unapologetically American restaurant. They kind of threw away the pretenses of being something they were not, and they celebrated the fact that there wasn't any rules. And
for me, Barry used to be a lawyer.
Yeah, Barry's a lawyer. He was self-taught. He taught us to have opinions and to think about food in a different way and think about how dishes came together in a way that's maybe as quaint now or accepted for now. It was quite revolutionary, I thought, at the time. And certainly for me, I got hired when I was returning from working in France and the traditions and the dogmatism, of a classical French cuisine. So it was a real eye-opening experience. And the first couple of years I was there in the early 80s, it was an American restaurant, but it was certainly influenced by European cuisines and French to a certain extent. But around 1985, 1986, can't quite remember when, during our summer break, when we closed for vacation, Barry and his family went to Japan. And when he came back and we reopened, he was a changed person. He was a changed man. He came back with boxes and boxes of plates.
Wow.
And a lot of the ceramic traditions of Japan. He brought that back, and he immediately wanted us to start serving the food at the Quilted on these plates. And back then, everything was round and white and Limoges and bone china. That's what people did around town. That's what was expected of fine dining. But he brought back these memories of the food that he had eaten, and he started to incorporate it into the menu. And for all the cooks, it was a real kind of slap to the face. Everything that we were doing, it literally happened after this trip and these boxes that came back. We shortened cooking times, with meat and fish. We served raw tuna, in sashimi-like slices, as opposed to like a tartare or something like this that was heavily seasoned. We started using fresh wasabi. We started soy sauce and shirodashis became a big part of what we were using in the kitchen. And it was an amazing experience, and everybody caught the bug in the kitchen. Everybody was really into it. We started, as cooks, going out after work. We started going to this whole slew of Japanese restaurants. It used to be in the West 40s. West 40s used to be a lot of Japanese restaurants. And I know there's a lot in the East 40s now, but in the West 40s on the other side of Fifth Avenue, there was all these slews of restaurants that were open late down in basements where the food was just izakayas that were just really tremendous. And it affected all of us. We had a great time, and it affected me so much that when my time came for me to leave the Quilted Giraffe, I wanted to go to Japan and work. And we had set up some connections, and I left the restaurant with Barry's blessing. Oddly enough, I had 3 or 4 months before my position in Japan started, so I went to visit my family that had just moved to California, and in Saratoga, which is right down the road from Los Gatos, which turned out to be, a precursor of what was going to happen later. But next stop was Japan. I left New York to go work and live in Japan.
Right. So, well, you cannot just go, right? So how did it happen?
It happened through a regular customer at the Quilted Giraffe who is a Japanese gentleman who had businesses both in New York and San Francisco and in Japan. And he had a hotel, and he had a Western-style restaurant there, and he needed a chef. He had a chef who was there now, but he was leaving to come back to the United States. And for me, It was an opportunity. You know, I wasn't going to learn Japanese food. For me, it was more about becoming immersed and living somewhere else, mm-hmm. and being becoming immersed in the culture in this new part of the world that I'd be living in, and learning as much as I could from it.
Mm-hmm. And right, it's not just on the plate, but the mindset.
Of course, of mm-hmm. course. And you know, you're young. You want new experiences, and it's the time to do it. It's right. time to do it. And funnily enough, it wasn't in Tokyo. It was in Fukuoka, which was a little bit off the beaten path.
Right. You know, Fukuoka,
the largest city on Kyushu.
Mm-hmm. It's at very south.
Yeah, the southernmost of the four major islands, and it was a great experience. It was a complete immersion. Mm. You know, the staff was all Japanese, and I got exposed to a lot. Everything from late night street food and stalls, mm. all the way to some really spectacular kaiseki meals in Kyoto. Taking the train up and eating great meals. So it was exactly what I wanted. It was an immersion in learning many, many different things.
Right. So how long did you stay there?
I was there for about 5 months.
Oh, wow. That's mm-hmm. a very intense culinary and cultural.
It was a really great experience. It was, you know, I was going to stay a little bit longer. It was cut short due to circumstances beyond my control. But I came back to, I didn't want to return to New York. So I settled back in California where I had family. Allowed me to get my feet back on the ground, and I started working again. But I never really lost, you know, what I found.
Okay. I just wanted to ask, is any cultural shock in the kitchen or something? Because you're surrounded by Japanese chefs, and Japan was totally new to you, right? So,
well, it's funnily enough, it was, I had staged in Europe, and ended up staging again in Europe after returning back from Japan. And every kitchen I worked at, there was always one Japanese cook in the kitchen who was staging as well. Mm-hmm. And they were there to learn, you know, classic French food or working in French restaurants. And they were always meticulous. They were hard workers. Their heads were down. And they had, obviously, the sharpest knives in the kitchen. You know, they had knives that... made everything else that we all had very, very primitive by comparison. So, they were going back. They were working and they were going back and cooking back in Japan, you know, French and Italian food.
Right. I think a couple months ago, I think there was an article in New York Times that the Japanese, how French restaurants are dominated by Japanese cooks now.
Yeah, there's a slew of great restaurants right now that are cooking in a very contemporary French style, as French as any Frenchman could do, too, you know, in honor of the tradition, doing a great job. The food's excellent.
Yeah, they go probably more religiously traditional to whatever the master taught them, and then preserve instead of American mindset is to come back and then you have to create something new by yourself.
Yes.
Right. So that's interesting. But, you know, what is the essence of, you know, your learning from Japanese kitchen culture?
I was, you know, in terms of food, I was fascinated by the purity of the food. Food tasted of what it was. There was a simplicity to it, but it was a complex simplicity. As we know, there's a lot of effort that's put into making something look effortless and very, very simple. The style was so deceptively simple that it became obvious that the quality of the ingredients was paramount to the success of a dish. You had no place to hide. There wasn't a thick sauce. Mm. There wasn't a lot of things on the plate to hide things. It was, you kind of put yourself out on a limb that this is what I have, and how this dish is going to be judged is by the quality of the ingredients. And what drives quality of ingredients is seasonality.
Mm.
And so it forces you, it's a style that forces you to cook with the seasons more than anything else. And, of course, I was fascinated by this. The other thing was the, you know, not to start talking about umami just yet, but the lack of fats. You know, everything we were taught, you know, in Western cuisines was that fat is flavor. You know, the three families of fat. You had olive oil, you had butter, and you had pork fat. And, you know, most Western cuisines can be defined by these three fats. And in Japan, it wasn't about fat. They had all these great flavors. things could be explosive and really, really balanced in flavor. But it wasn't because of their reliance on fat. And I wanted to know how they did that. That I found intriguing, especially being in California and the way people ate in California, as opposed to the East Coast, which was still kind of, you know, being driven by a European model on what fine dining was. And that's what I chose to explore and to try and figure out.
Right. So interesting. So you're going to say something about umami? That's the replacement of the fat, you think?
Yeah, I think it has a lot to do. I mean, obviously dashi, you know, dashi is the key to almost everything that's done in Japanese food. And, and you know, dashi is, you know, it's that complex, that simple complexity of, that complex simplicity, excuse me, of umami, creating a synergy, you know, to where something can be not have a lot of fat, but can be very satiating. It can make you full. It can make you satisfied. Yet, you know, the ability not to feel leaden down and to continue to go about your day, being alert by in mind, alert in body, and learning how to make correct dashi, understanding the principle of umami and amino acids mixed with the glycemic acids with the kombu is pretty fascinating concepts.
Right, because there's a synergy. If you have a kombu and if you have a bonito, there's a synergy, right? That kind of thing. Right. Well, I was speaking with the food scientist from Japan yesterday, and he said, as a key of Japanese cuisine, if you have a dashi soup at the beginning, and then the umami stays in your palate. So that's the...
Makes perfect sense. Something else I thought was fascinating, too, and different, and it's really interesting, is the use of bitterness at the beginning of a meal as well. You know, a lot of times we like to serve things that are salty here in America, you know, maybe to make people thirstier or feeling, you know, to get the palate going. But it's actually kind of the opposite. I've always noticed that in a lot of meals in Japan, especially kaiseki meals, that they'll start with something, usually like with a bitter green. But, you know, there's an emphasis on bitterness and a complete lack of sugar because bitterness is really the key to enlivening the appetite and preparing the appetite for a meal that's coming.
Right.
And that's something that we try to use, is starting with something that's not salty, but something that has bitter in nature.
I recently read an article that it says in Western cuisine, you eat a bitter salad, like Italian or something, at the end. And then by doing that, you crave for more sugar. So you tend to overeat and deserve it.
Entirely possible. Entirely possible. You know, I mean, we use dashi at Manresa. I mean, you know, for me at Manresa, I don't want things to be overtly Japanese in any kind of way. You know, if we use a fundamental tenet or principle, whether it's based on umami or a course progression or the way we use a particular ingredient, it's important to me that it doesn't seem like, oh, we're doing a Japanese dish, but we incorporate it into the style that we do. You don't really know it's there unless you really, really dig deep. You know, because what we're trying to do is make food that tastes good and makes the guests happy.
Right. But it sounds like, you know, as far as I've got your book, and then each dish looks like more simplified, less is more kind of approach and presentation. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's, I would imagine, some kaiseki mind.
Yeah, I think so. You know, dishes tend to be small, not because we want to serve a lot of smaller courses, but, you know, you want kind of a less is more rule, you know, after a couple of bites, you know, there starts to be a little bit of a fatigue with the familiar flavors and time to change things up.
Right. So what kind of dishes do you have, the Japanese influenced dishes do you serve?
Well, we usually do a raw dish of some sort. We usually do a, you know, whether it's a crudo or a sashimi type of dish. We use not much fat right now. We have a garden dish, a salad dish that has a lot of bitter proponents that served very early in the meal as well. We are doing a soup. We are doing a consomme that is like a chicken consomme, but it actually is dashi-based. We have some kombu and bonito in along with the roasted chicken bones. Roasted chicken, especially the bones, has a very, very high natural umami, like tomatoes and Parmesan and other Western ingredients.
Right.
And then it has little dumplings that are flavored with the Okinawan black sugar in it, along with the vegetables, which is pretty interesting. It has abalone in it, too. It's pretty interesting.
Wow. Yeah. Right now. That makes sense. I've never heard of that, you know, the Japanese dashi mixed with chicken stock.
So. It can be very, very good.
Mm.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's take a quick break here. And then when we come back, we'll talk about David's very unique and inspiring relationship with farms and like Japanese kaiseki chefs. So please stay with us.
Music for this commercial break is brought to you by Takstar. And this track is called Pianissimo Short.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's unique store in Lower Manhattan is home to perhaps the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan, plus the rarest natural sharpening stones and exquisitely designed tableware. They also host special events such as knife sharpening demonstrations and parties with New York's most famous chefs and restaurateurs. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the implicit and elegance of Japanese culture to your table, be it in your home or in the finest restaurant. For more information, visit korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from our studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is David Kinch, who is the chef owner of Marissa in Los Gatos, California, and which has three Michelin star restaurants. And, okay, so one of the core elements of Japanese cuisine is seasonality, as you talked. And kaiseki chefs say there are 24 seasons a year at their restaurants. So in Kyoto, for example, many kaiseki chefs have close relationships with local farmers, and Marissa is known for beautiful seasonal dishes. So what is your philosophy about seasons and ingredients at the Marissa?
Well, we try to be as honored of the seasons as much as we possibly can. California is, you know, a little bit different. It's a little bit more Mediterranean. We're more dry than wet than a traditional spring, summer, winter, fall, even though we still do have that. And we're very, very lucky in California. I think it's one of those special places on the planet where we have great quality fish and meats, fruits and vegetables straight across the board, a great growing climate, and we also have the culture about growing and understanding the importance of the food that we put in our bodies. That said, seasonality wins on all fronts. You serve something in season, not only is the product the best that it can possibly be, but it also tends to be the cheapest it's going to be, because you're not importing it, you're not trucking it in, you're not flying it in. So it's a win-win situation. People really don't have any excuse to not serve a menu that's seasonally based.
Right. But like, you know, Kyoto Kaiseki Chef 24 season, I'm sure there's so many produce coming one after another.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like one day it's spring, then the next day it's summer. It doesn't. Right. It's not like a door opening and closing. There's, you know, things fade in and out. You can have a couple products. You can have like asparagus and peas. People say they're both in springtime. Mm. Fact of the matter is, they're at very different parts of springtime. One very, very early, and another kind of mid to late. Mm. So, you know, this concept of micro seasons, you know, 24 seasons, it's really about a starting, beginning, and end, and the phasing out. And then you throw in the vagaries of weather patterns, you know, where you have not that much rain in the wintertime, or a longer than usual summer, and it kind of throws things a little bit differently.
Right. So so you work with farmers, right? So
yes.
And it sounds like very close by.
Yes, everything, you know, we either pick up ourselves or are delivered by the farms themselves.
Wow.
To the restaurants. And you know, we have one menu. We don't need the diversity of product that we had maybe 5 years ago, but we need more of specific products that are in season. So that's working out really good for us right now.
Okay. So you can feature one item kind of themed menu, like corn or
very much so, and that goes a long way toward it's a big part of how we develop menus too. We don't necessarily think of dishes. We tend to have a great example of something that's in season in front of us, and we work backwards. That I don't want to say backwards, but we kind of work from that as a starting point into how the dish develops.
Okay. So do you work, how do you work with the farmers? Do they bring you items or you ask in advance?
We work with them on what's planted, what goes into the ground. And of course they have ideas about things that they're passionate about growing. And we try to be flexible and understand what they're working with. And that's part of the fun. There's not many things that we don't like working with.
Right. So actually, it's kind of a collaboration, right?
Very much so. Very much so.
That's interesting.
It has to be.
Right. And because you're so close to them, I'm sure that you can, you know, like usually in the market or the bigger market, through a big distribution company, you don't see that Michael season, right?
No, you just see a box. You see a box or, you know, a plastic or cellophane, that sort of thing.
Right.
It's nice to get things that are, you know, still a little bit dirty. The roots are dirty. They're not cold because they haven't seen refrigeration. You know, they've been picked in the morning and they're packed and they're driven to the restaurants. It's very special. It's an intangible. It's one of those intangibles that make things great as opposed to good.
Right, and I heard that it keeps you healthy because of a lot of good bacteria attached to vegetables.
Entirely possible.
Right. Yeah, the farms you work with, how far are they usually?
The two that we're working with now, one is it's up on Zelman Road, so it's about 8 miles away. And the other one's on the other side of the hill, up the coast a little bit, so it's about 25 miles away from
that. Wow. The dream of chefs, I think.
It's nice. It's nice.
Okay. And is that why you have only one tasting menu, because of the flexibility?
It's been an evolution getting to the one menu. I mean, we used to have a couple menus and an a la carte, and it slowly got smaller and smaller. We became more focused on particular dishes and the experience we were trying to create with guests. Right now, we want the menu to be just basically a distillation of what we feel is the best that we can do that day. Not only ambience and service, but the food, the product that's available, and the menu that we put together. We have, of course, in this day and age, restrictions and allergies are a big part of you know, any restaurant's customer base. And we work very, very hard into not saying no, within reason, not saying no. So we're always creating variations of dishes and or substitutions for that. So that keeps us busy.
Right. I'm curious, though. Like, one day you found something like, I don't know what to make out of this vegetable or something like that.
No, I don't think that. That's not, you know, it's a good team. We have a good team. We're inspired by where we are and what we work with. We're inspired by working with each other. It's good. And it's a spirit of collaboration. And we all like going to work. We all, you know, are very passionate about what we do.
Okay. And earlier you said you're proud of being a part of that Los Gatos area.
Yeah, very much so. And I think it's important to state, too, you shouldn't be afraid of making mistakes. You know, we all make mistakes. I think we all tend to learn from, you know, trial and error, working with the product when you're trying to create something new.
Right. And in Kyoto, they have a native vegetables called the Kyoyasai. It's about like 35 different types. And so in Los Gatos, do you have any native produce, that kind of special terroir?
Native produce. You know, what grows really well where we are brassicas. We have cold nights. We have cool nights. The ocean is very tempering influence. So warm days, very strong sun days,
followed by cool evenings. It's one of the reasons why wine grapes do grow so well there. And for this kind of product, things like garlic and broccoli, artichokes, Brussels sprouts, all different kinds of lettuces, those have always been the iconic crops of the central coast of California.
Right. So I'm kind of getting jealous because you have everything, and you know.
Well, we don't have everything. We don't have everything, but it could be worse.
Yeah. For instance, Blue Hillstone Barns by Dan Barber, they grow everything by themselves, which is the dream of chef or any restaurant business,
right?
But instead, most of us go to Union Square Market, and then you cannot get everything from the market. So what do you think is the importance of the relationship between chefs and farmers in modern...
It helps to be connected. It certainly helps to be connected. You know, chefs can use their relationships with farmers to be a source of inspiration for not only what they're producing now, but, you know, in anticipating what's going to be growing later. Farmers, you know, being a farmer is tough. It's a hard profession. But also the impression I get, too, can be very, very satisfying. And I think to them it gives them a certain sense of security and perhaps a good feeling knowing that what they're growing is going to be sold, it's going to be used and treated with respect, that it's not all for naught.
Right. Well, it sounds like, as far as I heard from you, you encourage farmers to try new things. It's kind of mutual support system that you have.
Yeah, it's we can all benefit.
So are there many chefs in West Coast doing it?
I don't know any off the top of my head, you know, kind of wrapped up in what we do.
I hope it's going to be the direction.
That would be great.
Right. Okay. And so you had a fire at Manresa in 2014, unfortunately, but I heard you gained a new perspective from the experience. So could you tell us about that?
We had a fire in July of 2014. We reopened in January of 2015. And looking back at it now, I thought we did a very good job in utilizing that time. We were very, very busy when the restaurant was closed. I think we were busier than we have ever been, certainly in the last 3 months going before opening. I think chefs who tend to be naturally curious and concerned about what they do and concerned about the guest experience, you know, we're always thinking, we're always restless. We're thinking of ideas about how we can improve ourselves and improve the guest experience. And a lot of times there just simply isn't enough hours in the day with everything, just day-to-day operations. And the closure from the fire and during the rebuilding process, it gave us an opportunity, me and the team, the managers, we had a chance to think through every step of the guest experience, from them entering the restaurants, what they see, what their greeting is, through the ambiance and the service, the food, all the way up to when we present a check and we say goodnight to them at the door. Every little step is, do we make eye contact? Are our smiles genuine? Is this really the kind of plate that we want to serve on this? Is it awkward to eat with this? You know, after they eat this course, where are they going to put the fork? You know, we actually had the opportunity to think about all these things, and we did, and we did, and we tried to incorporate what we learned about ourselves back in when we reopened.
That's great. So there was a reason, maybe.
Well, I hope that wasn't the reason, but. I think it was a good use of time.
Right. Yeah. So that was the point. It was 12 years, so it's a good time to review. It's like everybody used to close 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, in the restaurant business, that's certainly middle-aged. You know, if you're around 12 years, we're going to be 15 years old next year. That's a lifetime in the restaurant business.
Right, and you just re-earned 3 Michelin stars for 2017.
Yes, we were awarded 3 stars last year, 2016.
Right, so congratulations.
Thank you.
And so, how many times have you been back to Japan since you came back from a job in Fukuoka?
I didn't go for a period of years because I was working and that sort of thing. But starting in 2008, I've been going back once or twice a year ever since.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm actually going next Friday. So.
Wow. So but when you go, what kind of restaurants do you go to?
I like to try a little bit of everything. You know, it's I'm not, you know, I love sushi, but I don't need to eat sushi five days in a row. I don't think anybody would. I try to bounce the experience out, try new things, both high-end and low-end. I'm going to Hokkaido on this trip for the first time. I'm really excited about that.
That's a whole other bounty.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's one of the great things about Japan. A lot of people don't realize is how regional it is.
Mm.
You can be every prefecture, you know, seems to have its own specialty, its own particular style sake. They make yuba in a different way than maybe. And I remember having this conversation asking about a product with a chef, and he'd never heard of it. And I found it really hard to believe that he hadn't heard of it. But then he was talking to another chef's friend, and he was kind of like, oh, yeah, that, you know, they do that in Nagoya. You know, kind of thing. And I was like, well, that's only 150 miles away from here.
Mm.
But and it's kind of like France. You know, the difference between Provence and Brittany is only, you know, it's just a couple hours drive. And how marked different what they drink, what they eat, the cheeses that they make, how different they are.
Right.
And you have the same thing in Japan. You have this marked, complex regionality that if you really want to dig into Japanese food and not just be in Tokyo and not just be in, you know, the urbane environment of Tokyo and the classical chakaiseki and in Kyoto, but if you go to you know, Kagoshima, or you go to outside of Kobe and along the Sea of Japan side, Kanazawa, you go up to the Rishiri Islands off the northern coast. You know, it's you'll encounter food that is unmistakably Japanese, but also completely different from not only anything you've ever had before, but what you had the day before when you were someplace else.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. And then I think their mindset is you have to preserve something traditional, and they have a mission.
Very much so. And I think, of course, Kyoto is a big part of that, you know, and preserving, you know, what they perceive as, you know, the cultural traditions. But I've noticed, especially in Tokyo, I've noticed in the past 8 or 10 years, they're really starting to, you know, I don't want to say experiment, but embracing outside ideas and using them very naturally in food that is still Japanese. I think that's great.
Mm. Do you have any example of that?
Well, you know, there's some chefs. There's a chef at a restaurant called L'Effervescence.
Mm-hmm.
Shinobu Name, I think his name is. And, you know, he spent time cooking in England and France and the United States. And he's gone back. And his food is Western, but it's also Japanese at the same time. It's hard to describe, but the way he uses the product on the plate, it's really fantastic. It's more of a feel, more of an intangible kind of feel to list exactly what's happening.
Mm.
I think it's great. I think it's great that in the past 10 years we've seen a tremendous amount of Westerners and Western cooks. It seems like a door's been opened, and more people are going to explore. And naturally, you have an exchange of ideas.
Right. Interesting.
It makes sense.
Right. Because I think it used to be like we talked earlier, you know, Japanese chefs work outside the country, come back, and then worship what he learned.
It's a generalization, but my feeling is that the best French restaurants and the best Italian restaurants in the world outside of France and Italy are probably in Japan. It's hard to argue with that.
Right. But then sounds like all those chef's conference, those things may be helping to open their mindset.
Very much so. Right. Very much so. And I think, you know, it's funny, but, you know, 15, 20 years ago, if you wanted to travel Japan and explore and eat, there wasn't a lot of there wasn't a lot of reference, certainly in English. There wasn't a lot of reference, and it's daunting, and the language and the alphabet. You know, especially you get outside of Tokyo, you know, you can get lost really, really quickly. And so it's daunting. You had to make a real effort to explore, as opposed to maybe being on a tour or something like this. And something happened. Something changed. I think, you know, I think the Michelin Guide of Japan being published in English was a big deal, because you had great restaurants where they listed addresses, phone numbers, hour opened, and a picture of the doorway, which was always, you know, you know, finding the place is half the battle. So all of a sudden you had this, you know, something kind of stripped away the veneer of the daunting aspect of going to eat at these restaurants. It changed a lot. And, of course, with the internet, you see a lot of things online now, too. Tabalog in English and that sort of thing, where people can explore and get a little bit deeper into the food. And people are obviously liking what they're finding.
Right. By the way, the first Michelin, Kyoto, was rejected by Kyoto chefs. So.
Yeah, yeah, but not anymore.
Right. Yeah, they started to realize how valuable it is.
Yeah.
Right. So, and you said you're going to Japan for the Ray Chateau Chef Congress?
Yes.
So what is it?
Well, Relais and Chateau is a restaurant and hotel organization started in France.
The world's best restaurants and hotels.
Yeah, it's a pretty prestigious organization. We're really honored to be a part of it. We were voted in last year, and every year all the properties get together in a different location. And this year it happens to be Tokyo, so that's where we're going over there. And it's going to be great because though there are a lot of Relais and Chateau properties in Asia, and there are some beautiful ryokans that are part of Relais and Chateau, for a lot of people and a lot of the property owners who are gathering there, they are realizing what Japan, the art of hospitality in Japan, can offer to their businesses, and also the power of the Japanese traveler. You know, in California, we have a tremendous amount of Japanese guests coming through. You know, we're pretty close, relatively speaking. I mean, San Francisco is closer to Tokyo than it is to Paris.
Right.
So, you know, Japanese travelers that we see, you know, they're educated, they're sophisticated, they're well traveled. They know what they want. And they're great guests. So I think the reason why Relais and Chateau is in Tokyo this year is to continue that relationship between Japan and the hotel guests.
Mm. So you're planning to do something outside the Congress?
I'm going to Hokkaido. Going up to Sapporo for a couple days.
Okay. Right. It's a skiing season coming up.
Yeah, I won't be skiing. I'm going to be eating.
Okay. Okay. So I look forward to your report.
Yeah.
Right. So what's your plan?
Well, it's a fairly short trip. We're going to go over and work for 3 days and then a couple days up. That's pretty much it.
Mm.
But nights are free. We have a couple of nice meals planned out.
Mm.
I'm visiting a couple of favorites, and I'm going to a couple of places I haven't been to before that have been recommended. My favorite bar in the world is in Tokyo, so I go.
Wow.
A place called Jus de Pêche. I don't know. It's in Roppongi.
Really?
It's very, very nice. Yeah.
Oh, wow. I have to check that out.
Great whiskey collection.
Mm, yeah. Including Japanese whiskey.
Of course. Yeah, of course.
Okay. So, please come back and talk more about your experience in Japan.
I'd love to. All you have to do is invite me.
I will, definitely. So thank you for joining us today, David.
Thank you very much, Akiko. Appreciate it.
So listeners, if you'd like to know more about David's activities, please visit maresarestaurant.com. That's Maresa, M-A-N-R-E-S-A, restaurant.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays, always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. We really appreciate your feedback. And today's show is made possible by Corin, and our engineer is Pierre Bienemet. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.